You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
It used to be the case that treaties to protect rights were the initiatives of governments or of international agencies. But the momentum has shifted. And if you think of the landmines treaty in 1997, that was very much a direct consequence of a campaign by civil society institutions. The year after the Landmines Treaty was the year that the Rome Treaty establishing the International Criminal Court was adopted. And that, too, was a direct consequence of civil society activism. More recently, about 4 years ago, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities was adopted, and by now, more than 100 governments have ratified that convention, and that is, again, very much a consequence of civil society activism. So there is a great significance in an initiative of this sort, in this case emerging from universities, and students at three universities who put together the International Migrants Bill of Rights. All three of our speakers this evening are associated with Georgetown University. I will introduce all of them now and then call on them to speak. Ian Kiesel is a 2010 graduate of the Georgetown Law Center, and while he was a student, he was engaged in the effort to put together the International Migrants Bill of Rights. That effort started in 2009. And so it has been underway for 2 years now, and he currently holds a fellowship at the American Civil Liberties Union and Human Rights Watch. I'm somewhat embarrassed to say that it is the Arié Nair Fellowship at the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, but I'm delighted that he is the person who currently holds that fellowship. Our next speaker will be Bianca Santos. She's even a more recent graduate of the Georgetown Law Center, a 2011 graduate, also has been engaged with the effort to develop the International Migrants Bill of Rights since 2009, she was also engaged, as Ian Kiesel was, in studies at Georgetown, which led to a certificate in refugees and humanitarian emergencies. And then Susan Martin, our wrap-up speaker, is the Donald Hertzberg Associate Professor of International Migration and the Director of the Institute for the Study of International Migration in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And she has a long record of engagement on refugee policy issues. Ian Kiesel will lead us, will lead off, and will speak about the law on these issues. And then Bianca Santos will speak about the advocacy effort, and Susan Martin we'll discuss the prospects for the International Migration Bill of Rights. So, Ian?
Thank you, Arya. And I want to just make sure from the beginning to emphasize our thanks to our hosts, the Open Society Foundation and the group of concerned grantmakers, as well as the International Migration Initiative within the foundations and the audience here this evening. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm going to provide a little bit of context and some background, an overview of international migration law and policy as it led to the development of the Migrants' Bill of Rights, and then present the structure and some of the content of the Migrants' Bill of Rights. As you may have seen if you've had a chance to take a look at the document, it's fairly long, and I don't want to assume that everyone here has either referenced it or it has an expertise in these issues. So the IMBR, the International Migrants Bill of Rights, really has to be seen against the backdrop of hundreds of years of international legal development with regard to the treatment of those outside of their country of origin. The rights of migrants are by no means something new. The law of state responsibility for injury to aliens, the law of diplomatic protections, claims commissions, espousal, these long predate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. International labor law, the first major institutional piece of the modern human rights system, refugee law, trade and investment law, statelessness, nationality law, international criminal law, and international human rights law, of course, which is the most robust and most recent. All of these bear on the issue of the protection of migrants' rights internationally. They're all areas of law that we've consulted, and they really do represent many hundreds of years of evolution of state practice with regard to migrants. Many states primarily deal with migration, and particularly labor migration, on a bilateral basis. For example, the proliferation of bilateral labor agreements in the between sending and receiving states in the 70s and 80s, and continued recent agreement that's been in the press between Australia and Malaysia with regard to asylum seekers arriving by sea. And in addition to all those areas of law that I've mentioned, of course, and perhaps most importantly, there are very, very important multilateral instruments and a few initiatives regarding international migration. So we have some very important International Labor Organization conventions, 97 and 143, and then, of course, the newest with regard to domestic workers. They provide a number of important legal protections for migrant laborers, and the International Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Their Family, which itself established a number of legal protections for various categories of migrants and their families, and we continue to follow the work of the treaty body with great interest. And then there have been efforts at international global migration governance, such as the Berne Initiative, that attempt to create a global framework to govern migration and flows of migration. And I say all of this just to show that given this patchwork, the starting legal position of the IMBR initiative, based on our research and drawing on from these different areas of law, in addition to studies of some of the instruments that Arya mentioned, is that there really is no single legal framework that unequivocally protects the rights of all international migrants. In short, the patchwork leaves significant gaps. I want to talk a little bit about international practice as well. As those here that work in the field know, and those grant makers who help structure that work, states do not adequately protect the rights of migrants. Our research and consultations have identified some areas that we have focused on in preparing the bill, including the rise of the detention of migrants internationally, including administrative detention, most concern. And yet, existing human rights law, properly interpreted, would provide for a presumption of non-detention and significant due process protection for migrants in deportation or removal proceedings or exclusion proceedings. Migrants are regularly subjected to discrimination on the basis of their status, and yet existing human rights law provides a strong right of equal protection and non-discrimination for all human beings. Global migration is on the rise, and mixed migration flows are now really the norm. For example, as the recent conflict in Libya began, flows of migrants out of Libya mixed with other Europe-bound migrants, challenging receiving states to distinguish between migrants moving for the purposes of family reunification, those fleeing persecution in Libya, those onward movers who had been granted some sort of refugee protection in Libya or had been returned under bilateral agreements after seeking refugee protection abroad, as well as, of course, labor migrants. So these challenges of application don't mean that the specialized protections that I started describing that have evolved over so many years, such as the all-important Refugee Convention for those fleeing persecution, are inadequate, but rather that there really is a need from a policy level for a generally applicable framework that applies to all migrants, no matter what motivated their border crossing. So this is really the starting policy position of the IMBR, that a document that would provide a baseline framework for protecting the rights of all migrants would be a useful tool for advocates, for the international community, and for individual states in setting policy and practice with regard to all flows of migrants. Such a framework can fill the gaps, and it can promote the further development of law. So let me tell you a little bit about the IMBR framework. Responding to these gaps in law and practice, students and academics who came together to draft the IMBR, and I should add, although we've discussed AUC and Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the London School of Economics Migration Studies Unit has also been an important and more recent partner, particularly as we discuss some of these complicated issues of state compliance and some of the political science aspect of that. It's hard to just have a bunch of lawyers in the room, as those of you who are lawyers might know or might want to admit or deign to admit. So we want to emphasize again that this is a draft document that we're discussing, and its legal commentaries have sought to restate and reformulate existing rights, as well as in a parallel move to posit a margin of enhancement that's consistent with progressive trends in practice and commentary. So the document really achieves, from a legal perspective, two things at once. One, to codify the existing law, drawing from these different areas that we've discussed, as well as in some areas where there are gaps, or where there's a growing consensus among states in particular regions or in commentary, to push the law a little bit, to provide a margin of enhancement. So we framed the IMBR, given this nature, as a soft law document that promotes the development of hard legal norms. The distinction between hard law and soft law is traditionally used to distinguish between legal rights and duties that states are formally bound to, and those with which states comply out of a sense of legal obligation coming from policy or moral or other basis. That's the soft law. So we propose a framework that's not envisioned as a treaty at this point, but rather restates existing law to which states are already bound and adds this margin of enhancement that we hope through development of compliance will harden over time into law. In this way, the IMBR, both in form and content, we feel complements the existing rights and obligations of states. So it complements the Migrant Workers Convention, it complements the Refugee Convention, complements the Convention Against Torture, complements the ILO conventions, while simultaneously drawing from them and in some cases pushing them a little bit farther. The Migrants' Bill of Rights is comprised of 19 substantive articles and lengthy commentaries that, we're working on revising after extensive consultation with the generous support of the Open Society Foundations in Geneva, in Dakar, in New York, and in Washington, D.C. over the course of the last 8 months. And the document draws from treaty law, from customary international law, from regional instruments, state practice, and commentary. And I just want to highlight a few provisions. There's a broad definition of migrants as any person that is outside of their country of citizenship. There's no duration or status or intent requirement. So there's a real focus on movement across borders to define international migration as a phenomenon. There's a rigorous and yet flexible equal protection clause. That there's insurance of uniform and broad civil and political rights, including due process protections that apply in administrative proceedings, a presumption of non-detention, a single non-refoulement provision that unites practice under the Convention Against Torture, the European Court of Human Rights, and the Refugee Convention. There are strong protections for vulnerable groups, labor provisions, a right of family unity that we feel is fairly robust, and the protection of minor migrants. And we feel that we've reflected the consensus and will endeavor to do so in continual revision within the human rights community with regard to certain economic, social, and cultural rights, including the right to the highest attainable standard of healthcare. And I want to, again, emphasize that the IMBR, although I've been speaking in a very legal and rather dry fashion, is not conceived of as just another treaty, but rather it's proposed as a soft law document, a kind of civil society promoted version of the guiding principles on internal displacement, who we know Susan Martin has worked very closely with, and we'd love to draw from her expertise in that area. And it's focused on international migration. So we think that it can really promote dialogue, as Maria Teresa was indicating, between civil society and states with regard to these rights, and think that a set of standards and not a treaty is an ideal way for civil society to engage in promoting a framework to protect migrants worldwide while complementing and enforcing the existing binding law and treaties that are there. Governments have already agreed to many of the core areas that protect the rights of migrants or can be pushed to agree to those treaty law that they haven't ratified. And our initiative promotes one single group of rights because it'll change the way that governments look at migrants. So we, even though all of these different areas of law come from different specific areas of application, one uniform set of rights that applies to all migrants in motion across a border has significant benefits in changing the way the states look at migrants and protect their rights. So with that, I'll just turn it over to my colleague Bianca to talk about our advocacy strategy.
Okay, Bianca Santos.
Thanks. Okay, so we have hundreds of pages of rights and commentaries, thousands of student man hours put in. Now, what are we going to do with this document? This is what we've been thinking about for the past couple of years. Our ultimate goal is to improve the conditions of migrants' rights through recognition of their rights and through advocacy. In other words, we have this dynamic blueprint. What are we going to do with it? We really want to put it in people's hands. We want people to use it. So based on our research, and we've done case studies of a couple of things that have been mentioned here, the guiding principles that Susan's worked on and the Mind Ban Treaty and the Disabilities Convention that Arya's mentioned, and this outreach that Ian's mentioned too. We've been to Geneva, we've been to Dakar, we've been to New York and DC. We've talked to a lot of people. And based on all of this work that we've done, we want to move forward in three areas: research, state compliance, and advocacy. And I'm going to run through these quickly, tell you all our ideas. And in the Q&A session, if you have any ideas, any feedback for us, we'd love to hear it. So first, research. Part of the feedback that we got from talking to experts in human rights in Geneva and international organizations was that our restatement of the law really needs to use all of the basic human rights documents as a baseline. So there's already a course at Georgetown that's moving forward with this. We're going to research and make sure that our restatement of the law really is a baseline of all of the major human rights documents. And Ian mentioned this margin of enhancement, where best practices and trends in migration law is heading. That's the second portion of our research, and that is moving forward as well. And one of the new pieces of this research is that we want to go into what's happening at the regional level. So that's one of the things that we've gotten feedback on. Lots of what's going on is there are lots of regional dialogues, new existing treaties, regional treaties, such as in the Americas, emerging regional treaties, such as in Asia, Southeast Asia, and that the IMBR not only would be stronger with these regional mechanisms as a source and a baseline, but that it would make it more practical for people. So someone in West Africa can look at the commentary and say, okay, this is what I can use on the regional level, as well as referencing these international law treaties. So we really think that would make the IMBR stronger. And the third piece of research are these focus papers, again, that Ian mentioned. We really want to look at some cross-cutting issues across the IMBR, one on vulnerable migrants and the other on economic, social, and cultural rights, and to make sure that the IMBR is consistent, consistent in its treatment of vulnerable migrants and in the rights that the economic, cultural, and social rights that we posit in the IMBR. The second piece that we want to move forward with is state compliance. Ultimately, we want to influence state practice. But initially, we want to really do something that tests the IMBR's legs, that takes the steps to put it into practice, and that results in a hybrid academic and advocacy piece. So what the initiative wants to do, we'll do is create a scorecard based on the IMBR's rights that's easy to use, and then partner with a university and an NGO in two or three different nations. We already have a partner with Bilgi University in Turkey, and we think we want to partner with a nation in Southeast Asia and in the Middle East. We know there's lots going on with migration there, and there are lots of issues, and some countries that are really pushing, and some countries that have a lot of issues to work with. And so we think that that creating a compliance an evaluation of a nation's compliance with the rights listed in the IMBR will be really helpful. And how will we do this? With the process that we've used already to create this IMBR, partnering with an academic institution, harnessing student enthusiasm. Students really want to get in there and not only learn, but do something that's practical, but also leveraging civil society expertise. So as I've said, we've met with experts in all of these different places, and that's how we as students are really able to learn and bring in what's really happening in the field into our research. We know this could be seen as a very ambitious undertaking, and it is, but we want to start small with just two or three key states and move forward with these compliance studies. Now, the third piece is advocacy. We want to spread the awareness of these rights. While there may be some people in the room here that know these core human rights, have these core human rights documents memorized, most people don't. So one of the value pieces of the IMBR is to have what many states already have agreed to through signing a treaty, the rights that they've agreed to give everyone, regardless of nationality or anything else. And also, even if a state isn't party to a particular human rights treaty, these are core norms that the human rights community and that the international community and that are out there in international law. So one of the values of the IMBR is just having all of these rights in the same place. But as I said, it's hundreds of pages of commentary, so we want to make it even more accessible to people out in the field. And we have a few concrete tasks that we think will really help with this. The first is creating a handbook. We want the IMBR to be accessible to non-lawyers, and we even want lawyers to be able to use it after an hour of reading through instead of a couple of hours of reading through it. So really to take the core ideas of the IMBR and in non-legal language explain how it can be used in a handbook. That's one of the main pieces of advocacy that we want to do. And Susan Martin wrote a handbook for the Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement, and it was a fantastic handbook and has been extremely successful. And I think she's going to talk about that a bit. So if you have any questions on, is a handbook really useful? How is it used in the field? Susan's the perfect person to ask. The second piece is pretty simple and straightforward, but it's translations. We need the if people in West Africa or in Latin America want to use the IMBR, they have to have it in a language that they can read it. So we think translating the IMBR, the commentaries, and the handbook into maybe French to begin with, French and Spanish, would be something that would really, again, get it into everyone's hands. Another advocacy piece that we want to do is migrant testimonials. We as lawyers have created this blueprint, and we want people to use it, but a piece of advocacy is to hear what migrants themselves think about these rights, how they view these rights, and a video interview of a migrant talking about a difficult family reunion situation, or any of the rights listed in the IMBR, we think can be a really useful advocacy piece and kind of another angle, another look at the rights in the IMBR. And then kind of to tie these things together, we want to do all of these things, and then we want to tell people about it. We want to train people in how to use the IMBR. So we're calling it trainings, but going out and telling people about the handbook, telling people how they can use the IMBR in advocacy, in setting national legislation, and in litigation. And we've had positive feedback on this. Again, in our trip to Dakar, we went there and met with migrants themselves, And they said, and they were creating something kind of a world charter for migrants, really what they thought their rights should be. And when we told them, well, here's this blueprint of where the international law stands, they said, wow, that's great. We would love to have a training on that. And it would be a great empowering tool. You could train some migrants, and then migrants can train migrants as an empowering tool. So that's something that we've received a bit of positive feedback on. And then finally, we want to create a website to make all of these things available. Right now, the IMBR itself is available at a website that is several characters long, includes SPPS, a couple backslashes, and it's not great, really effective advocacy to be able to, you know, you want to have something, imbr.com or something like that. So we really want to make, it's another part of making the IMBR accessible to anyone and everyone who wants it. And throughout this, we want to accomplish these things in time for the 2013 UN High-Level Dialogue on Migration and Development. We think that it's a really good advocacy goal, and we know that there will be a lot leading up to that, a lot of discussion. There already is a lot of discussion on migration and development leading up to that high-level dialogue. And as we go through these things, we want to continue the outreach we've done. We've talked to academics in Boston, migrants in Senegal, human rights experts in Geneva, and they've all given us great feedback. And yes, this could be a great soft law tool, so we just want to continue that process. Again, before I turn it over to Susan, if you have any thoughts on anything I've said, we'd love to hear them in the Q&A.
Okay, very good. Susan Martin.
Thank you. Before I start, I just want to recognize two faculty from Georgetown who have been much, much more involved in this than I have been. Towards the back, Alex Lenikoff, who is now the Deputy UN High Commissioner for Refugees, but was the Dean of the School of Law at Georgetown, and was the one who really got this process underway and provided the way in which the students were able to pick up on these issues and move it forward. And then my colleague, Andy Schoenholtz, in the front, who has picked up basically on these issues and has been mentoring and guiding the students on it. And so for some of the Q&A, very well be questions that should be posed more to them. I see Alex grimacing at this point. But I think that let me start by summarizing some of what I see to be the real importance of having a very succinct document that spells out the core rights of migrants. As Ian was saying, we have a lot of instruments. Certainly migrants are covered under most, just about all of the major provisions in international human rights law, in humanitarian law, in refugee law, certainly, on that. But part of the weakness that we have in terms of migrant-specific law is that we have conventions for the rights of refugees, those who flee persecution, and we have a range of conventions for labor migrants, people who are moving from one country to another, specifically for work purposes. But we have a much, much more complex system and process of migration today than those two extremes, in some sense, allow for. And so what a Migrant Bill of Rights does is it outlines what are the core rights for all migrants, regardless of the reasons that they have migrated. And we have a lot of people who migrate today for mixed motives. They're leaving countries because of conflict, but they're choosing countries because of their economic opportunities. They're not unidimensional. People don't make decisions based on one specific factor. A lot of different issues come into being. We have people who migrate because of earthquakes or because of hurricane cyclones. We're positing that as climate change intensifies those natural hazards, we'll probably see a lot more migration that is generated, at least in part, by these natural hazards. We have people who are fleeing political instability, as we've seen in Northern Africa, who may not necessarily have a well-founded fear of persecution themselves, but they're living in places which are so unstable that it's not tenuous for them. You know, it's just too tenuous for them, and they leave as a result of those factors. Some of them are already migrants. So labor migrants become forced migrants when the countries in which they live implode. And we have a very, very complex system, a set of migration, but we don't have consensus with regard to what are the core rights of those who migrate, regardless of what the initial causes are or combination of causes for the their migration. So in one sense, the International Migrants Bill of Rights is important because it begins to lay out what those core rights are that apply across the board to migrants and certainly apply to those who have these mixed motives for migration or who have where there's a lot of complexity in terms of their movements. And you don't have to go to multiple documents in order to be able to figure out what their rights are. It's also important because there are a lot of issues that do fall between the cracks or aren't well defined in international law. I mentioned that in the political instability in North Africa, a lot of the people who migrated were migrants. They were people who had come as contract workers to Libya and other countries in the region. This is a recurrent problem, but it's, yes, national governments do have the responsibility for their citizens who are working in other countries, but what's the role of the international community? What are the rights of the individuals who may have actually been paying money to support their evacuation if it's needed, but what's their redress if their government doesn't help them out? And that's in fact actually what's happened in a number of cases. So we have really difficult issues that weren't necessarily envisioned sufficiently in existing law. Second problem is that some of the international law that pertains very directly to migration, to migrants, aren't well ratified. The Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers has not been ratified by any major destination country of migrants. That makes it a difficult instrument to use, given that it's only source countries that are saying what are these rights, but not destination countries. The conventions that the International Labor Organization has adopted are also not particularly well ratified, that even define what migrant workers have as in the way of rights. And there are lots of reasons for this low level of ratification, but one of the reasons is that these instruments are extremely complicated, and they often have provisions that are very difficult to implement and that call into question for states whether they're taking on responsibilities, frankly, for people who are not legally in their countries and raises all sorts of issues of national sovereignty. Even though I think a close reading of the Migrant Workers Convention would show that almost most states that have not ratified it or recognized most of the provisions anyway, it's a hard sell. Even countries that have ratified it have expressed some doubt about their capacity to actually implement the provisions in it because there's so much, but no sense of what are the priorities. So what the International Migrant Bill of Rights does is in effect say what the priorities are. What are those core interests that have to be met? And then the third aspect is that we know that there's a tremendous gap between the aspirations in all of the existing international law and the reality on the ground. We know that states that have not that have ratified instruments, whether it's the Refugee Convention or the Labor Migration Conventions, can proudly say they've ratified it, but they don't necessarily implement those instruments. And we, again, it's very hard to advocate for all of the provisions of those instruments when there isn't a sense of what are the priorities and what is so fundamental that at a minimum a government must adhere to those issues. And the soft law instrument is a way of setting out that normative framework. So given that, I think, you know, this is really an essential tool for improving protection of migrants. What are the prospects for moving forward? I'm actually fairly optimistic that this is a propitious time to move ahead, despite the fact that I think that there is so much concern, particularly because of the economic crises, political crises taking place. You know, there are real concerns about international migration, but I think real agreement amongst states, within civil society, amongst international organizations, that we need to have better ways in which we manage a system that is largely broken. And migrant rights is a part of that dialogue of how do we fix a broken immigration or migration system. Governments have been expanding the venues and mechanisms that they've put in place for now trying to work together to address migration issues. Migration, in one respect, is the last bastion of sovereignty. Who comes into your territory, how to protect your borders. But governments are also recognizing that you can't do it alone, that it's a transnational phenomenon if you don't have some kind of cooperation between source and destination countries and the migrants themselves, that many of the policies just fail. We certainly can see that in the United States with the 11 million who are here without documents. So governments have been expanding bilateral agreements, regional mechanisms for consultation and discussions, and now increasingly looking for more global means by which they can come to some sort of consensus. They're not ready for binding instruments, which is what the beauty of a soft law approach is, because it's very clear governments don't want decision-making processes. They want consultative processes through which they can come to consensus and agreement on their own and not adopt conventions that they're not going to ratify and not going to implement, but work around it. The Global Forum on Migration and Development is now in its fourth year, and it's been involving a lot of governments, and migrant rights has been a prominent part of the agenda. For those discussions. It's lead up to the high-level dialogue in 2013, which will involve all of the members of the United Nations. And so there's a venue for putting some of these issues on the table. I'll come back to how they're being put on the table. International organizations have also been doing a lot more to try to figure out how they can cooperate on migration issues, and migrant rights has been probably the principal area in which they have seen that there's some area where they can come together and try to be helpful to states. And of course, civil society has also been working for many, many years on trying to figure out better ways of promoting the rights of migrants and protecting those rights. And they are involved in some of the mechanisms like the Global Forum for Migration and Development. There's a parallel process that is now becoming more and more integrated into the formal processes. It's very fragile, though. It's highly dependent on a few foundations for resources and support, at least for the civil society participation. It doesn't have a secretariat or an institutional form for it, and they're trying very much to balance how much to be reactive in responding to the government's agenda and how much to be proactive and trying to set a government agenda. And again, migrant rights issues are at the core of that tension in terms of reaction versus proactive. The strength of this civil society process in the Global Forum is that, unlike almost every other civil society or NGO forum in international areas, this one has a very, very strong representation of migrant-led associations and organizations. So the migrants themselves aren't in the back seat. And over the last few years, they've been taking more and more of a leadership role. And so it's a venue for being able to give some voice to migrants in what has largely, up until now, been a state-owned discussion of these issues. As I said, all of these sectors, government, international organization, civil society, see migrant rights as the core of, at the core of a lot of their interests in these issues. The leadership has come from rather strange places, though. There are a lot of likely, you know, suspects in terms of the leadership in talking about rights. You've got human rights groups, you've got some of the migrant associations, and the international area, the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights, UNICEF, others who see themselves as having a human rights mandate in their discussions, and civil society, human rights groups, et cetera, labor unions. But there are some pretty unlikely players. The United Arab Emirates. One would not see the UAE as the bastion of interest in migrant rights issues. But they're dealing with a very, very difficult situation. 75-80% of their population are migrant workers, and some with family, some without. It's a higher percentage of their workforce. They're not prepared to give citizenship to those migrants, but they understand they have an unsustainable situation if the migrants have no rights and are completely exploitable. And so they're struggling with trying to figure out where the balance is, what they can do with it. The World Bank, again, not a bastion of support for rights, but they have a whole division now that's dealing with social protection issues and see migrants as an important part of that discussion, and have actually asked me to do some work for them in the Middle East and North Africa in trying to lay out what the governments are actually doing on migrant protection in that area. So again, we've got a really interesting set of players that aren't just talking to others who are converted. They're also talking to and with those that have been, highly guilty, frankly, of rights violations. So I think what we are seeing then is that a soft law framework like the International Migrant Bill of Rights can become a basis for forging greater consensus amongst governments on a core set of norms and values that doesn't force states to move too far away from things that they've already endorsed in the broad set of human rights instruments, but provides an opportunity for them to start prioritizing and work with civil society in some of these mechanisms in order to be able to set out what are the core values of a migration system that need to be respected regardless of why people have moved, for how long, and in what status. And that, I think, is the reason that I'm somewhat optimistic that a process of this sort can help governments with the very, very strong representation of civil society in moving ahead on what has been a very contentious, quite controversial set of issues.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask a couple of questions and then open it up. And the questions I want to ask, deal with issues of advocacy and the prospects. This is not a great moment in many parts of the world to be promoting the rights of migrants, and I think particularly of the West European democracies. Recently, governments such as France and Italy have behaved particularly badly in dealing with migrants, and even some of the West European democracies, like the Netherlands and the Scandinavian countries, are not the the reliable allies on rights issues that one has expected when other questions come before them. Migrant issues are politically very controversial in those countries, and antagonism to migrants is gaining strength. And so my question is, have you thought about what you can do in that not very welcoming environment at this point? Do you have a strategy for the West European countries?
I think because of the realities that you've talked about, we don't really want to focus on West European countries. As we, it's part of the reason that we want to, especially with these compliance studies, choose a nation from Southeast Asia, and choose a nation from the Gulf, perhaps the Middle East, where there, while the issues are contentious, of course, but there might be room for advocacy. As Susan mentioned, the UAE is receptive. Qatar is going to host the World Cup, so there'll be a lot of focus on that. And even though it's 10 years away, they're already starting to build, and I think there's going to be a lot of media focus on that. And the Philippines has been a nation that really pushes for rights there. So I think we want to focus on areas where there are a lot of issues, but that there is room for advocacy.
Yeah. When you mentioned the Philippines, and that also reminds me of your reference to Bilgi University in Turkey, those would seem to be natural allies. That is, Bilgi University is a particularly rights-minded university in Istanbul. It has done very important things with respect to the Roma minority in Turkey, which is quite a large minority. In Turkey, the campus is actually located in a Roma neighborhood of Istanbul, and the university refurbished the local high school and has done quite a lot of things to assist the Roma community. So I would imagine Bilgi University would be the a natural ally, but in Turkey, there is considerable concern for Turkish migrants in Europe, in Germany, and in other countries. And I would think a concern with migrant rights is quite significant in Turkey. As far as the Philippines is concerned, of the various countries that provide domestic laborers for the Gulf countries, the Philippines has been the most vigilant in protecting the rights of its citizens who are working in the Gulf, much more vigilant than the South Asian countries or Indonesia, which also supply large numbers of domestic workers for the Gulf states. So I think the Philippines would be a sort of natural ally. And, you know, one can pick a number of governments like that in different parts of the world. And if one can work with them, one can help to generate quite a lot of momentum behind a migrant's Bill of Rights.
Yeah. I wouldn't write off the Europeans, though, in this.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, on that, for a few reasons. That one, again, you don't want to get back into the same situation we have with the Migrant Workers Convention. You've got the source countries signing on, destination countries don't. Then you've got a meaningless document because...
No, and look, I could reinforce what you say by you know, a story about... things in Europe. There's actually a migrants' rights organization in Europe, which is active in Brussels in connection with the European Union, and they took advantage of a negative development in Europe a number of years ago and used it to secure a great advance in rights in Europe. You may recall that there was a period in which Jörg Haider was a politically successful leader in Austria. And at the time, Europe was very embarrassed by the Haider phenomenon. And so that migration rights organization actually took the lead in persuading the European Union to draft the EU's directive on racism. It was a directive which every country that is a member of the European Union or that sought membership in the European Union had to implement within a three-year period. There has been considerable difficulty about the implementation of the directive. Nevertheless, it produced a tremendous advance in Europe on racial equality issues, and in fact, at that moment, European law leapfrogged over American law in terms of the legal protections provided for racial equality. So sometimes one can use adverse developments and take advantage of them. Precisely at that moment to secure protections of rights. This requires a kind of well-developed, systematic advocacy effort by people who are sort of deeply plugged in to the political processes in various parts of the world. And the woman who was instrumental in doing this, a woman named Isabel Chopin, was that kind of sort of plugged-in person. And it's largely to her credit that the European Race Directive was developed. What do you know the name of her organization? It was the Migration Policy something, rather. Okay, but
Rights International?
No,
it wasn't.
No, I'm forgetting the exact name of the organization, but I remember the individual who led the effort. So there are possibilities at times of doing things like that. But I think the easier strategy is to try to enlist support in countries like the Philippines and Turkey, where there's a natural concern with migrants from their own countries who are abused in other countries, and I think they could be very significant allies.
Well, and just to jump in terms of the kind of mechanical or the approach to this, that I think one of the appeals of the idea of doing the compliance studies in partnership with a national university and a civil society organization is exactly to anticipate what those advocacy opportunities are at the national level, and enlist the help of often elites within within those societies, people who are being consulted by governments. The professor with whom we've begun to work at Bilgi was returning from a recent meeting with parliamentarians on a new migration law when we had our first call, and these are things that I think make, at least from our perspective, the advocacy strategy that we envision is one that will leave a very lean and mean organization that, as Bianca was saying, makes great use of the enthusiasm of academics and students as we already have in our growing network to date.
Okay, let me open it up to the floor, and if you'd line up with the mic and if you'd identify yourself in asking a question. Okay.
I'll go first since I have the prime seat right next to the microphone. My name is Amy Mudin. I'm with the International Organization for Migration. Thank you very much for the Open Society Foundation for hosting this event. This has been extraordinarily interesting. I've heard a little bit about the IMBR from my colleagues that I believe you may have consulted in Geneva when you're doing the whole Geneva consultation. So this is the first time I'm actually here to hear all of this, and it's incredibly interesting. I have many things to say, but I'm going to be as concise as I possibly can. Susan, you were talking about a number of the international organizations who have been working on this issue, and IOM with a number of UN agencies, 14 agencies, and the World Bank. We are the Global Migration Group, so we're focusing on a number of migration issues. And at least 2 years ago, we published a book on international migration and human rights, and I don't know if any of the authors of this IMBR has seen this, but we'd be more than willing to make it available for you as you continue on. You were mentioning briefly, Mr. Nair, how it would be important to engage a number of the Western states into this, specifically using the example of how Italy and France have responded to the crisis in Libya and the outflow of migrants.
I'm also thinking of the way that they have dealt with Roma in recent times. The Berlusconi government and Sarkozy have been really horrendous in dealing with the Roma, and in some cases they're dealing with indigenous Roma, but they're referring to all of them as migrants and deporting them and so forth.
No, I agree. I just wanted to point out this interesting fact in terms of the migrant workers who have been leaving Libya. Right now, we're well over 600,000 of them who have left. And of course, there's been a lot of concern by parts of Europe that a number of them may be coming to their shores. But when we look at those figures, it's actually less than 3% who've come there. So I think in the back of our minds, a lot of people do think of migration as being very south to north, when in fact, even though there's 214 international migrants around the world, almost half of them are south-south migration flows. So you are seeing a lot of migrants who are going from parts of Southeast Asia into the Middle East, throughout Latin America, and throughout Africa. So I think you have a right idea in mind in terms of looking at those countries in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia. I've been following in my office here in New York for a number of years the migration discourse in the UN and outside of the UN. And I recall the 2006 high-level dialogue on international migration. And in that year, they linked it to development. So they were talking about international migration in the context of development, which was very interesting. And it kind of avoided, for the most part, this polarizing North-South debate. Since then, we've seen the Global Forum on Migration and Development move forward. And over the years, we've seen a lot more of the discourse, as you were saying, take on the human rights elements of it. And of course, I think we've seen, you know, maybe those hosting governments, which might have been considered countries of origin, really pushing that agenda a lot more. And as we move towards the high-level dialogue in 2013, we don't know yet what those themes are going to be, but it would be surprising if they did not touch on the human rights element at all. My question, I thought you explained really well why there's a need for this soft law, and pointing out that the Migrant Workers Convention is so poorly ratified, mainly by countries of origin, and also many times poorly implemented for a variety of reasons. But I wonder if the IMBR would distract from further ratification or implementation of the Migrant Workers Convention, if there is a way to also advocate for furthering that, to take that hard law which is there, which for those countries who have ratified it, they are obligated to oblige by it, as opposed to soft law. And I'm not a legal expert, so I may be a little off on this. Soft law is more optional. So I'm kind of wondering what the relationship between those two would really be, and also if you've been consulting governments in this process. Thank you.
I'll begin. I think initially I just want to stress again, I mean, our sense and the outreach that we've done and the research that we've done suggests that a parallel soft law framework actually, while we have spoken to a number of advocates who are concerned about the risk to ratification campaigns, we feel like there's room for a parallel initiative to promote a soft law framework that actually draws from those very those treaties and will then support and continue to support both the ratification of, but also the development of those hard law norms. So, just from our sort of technical perspective on that, and given the outreach that we've done, we don't see a significant risk. Although we're obviously sensitive to concerns of actors in civil society and among international organizations that that there might be a risk to those campaigns, but our perspective really is one that the more attention to the violation of migrants' rights, the more likely it is that those rights will be protected. As to the second part of your question about consulting states, we've done a small number of consultations with states. Initially, we focused mostly on civil society organizations. We've spoken to some officials in the initial stages of our consultation with the State Department here in Washington. We spoke to some officials, European Union officials who follow migration in Geneva when we were there, and really anticipate further outreach to states once the document is closer to a final draft, so that we can really draw in comments there.
Anybody else want to?
I agree with Ian that these can be effectively parallel processes. I'm also very, very skeptical that ratification campaigns are going to work for the vast majority of the destination countries. So I think that putting one's eggs in that basket means there won't be anything. But also, as I was, you know, was saying, is that if there are a lot of migrants who aren't migrant workers, and if putting all of one's focus on that vehicle means that we're ignoring an awful lot of the international migration, which is a lot more complex than going as a migrant worker. And this reminds me also the debate over the guiding principles on internal displacement. There were a lot of advocates and civil society organizations who were very concerned that if you had something like the guiding principles on for internally displaced, it would erode refugee protection. But the vast, you know, a much larger number of people were internally displaced, and I couldn't buy, on, you know, an ethical basis, saying they should be without any attention to their rights because we want to make sure that we're protecting people who might fall under the Refugee Convention if they just managed to get across a border. And so I don't think we should be pitting different mechanisms against each other in that way.
Hi, how are you? My name is Kate Sifkin. My affiliation is with Human Rights Watch. I work directly on the report about the severe migrant abuse in Kazakhstan by the various entities there. My question was more based on the observation that we made during the field work, is that the government is obviously very reluctant to help out, but there are entities, as you've mentioned, Susan, surprising entities that sometimes cooperate and sometimes have it in their bizarre interest to help out. In our case, because most of the workers were tobacco farmers, it was Philip Morris. It was a very strange bedfellow for a lot of the human rights community. But I'm wondering whether you presented some of the major transnational corporations that are currently, because of the corporate crisis right now, are paranoid about their image that they're projecting and somehow subvert this crisis in the corporate culture to the advantage of, you know, solving the problem of migration abuse. I'm wondering whether you're talking to corporations about this.
I'm not sure that you respond to in terms of this, but yeah. Interestingly, there's a working group at the World Economic Forum that's coming out with a set of principles in terms of migration. And it, obviously, you know, their makeup, it means that they are trying to think about what, from the corporate interest, are the core rights and values that need and norms that need to be in place.
Right. That would be much more meetable with the soft law aspect of it, kind of talking to them in the language of soft law as far as their corporate culture is concerned. Great. Thank you.
And just to answer your question, no, we have, to date, we have not approached any corporations, but that is has been part of our thinking. And we agree with you that corporations could be a great partner and someone to talk to.
Hi, I'm David Wildman. I'm with the United Methodist Church Board of Global Ministries in our human rights and racial justice area. Thank you, everybody. I want to ask a question just about the two questions quickly. The definition of a migrant as someone who's living outside their place of citizenship. It seems to me that the U.S. has at least 100,000 migrants in Afghanistan right now, and over 50,000 migrants in Iraq. So I'm wondering, you know, there's a number of categories of folks that are working in other countries as soldiers, as mercenaries, business executives, you know, retirees. So help me out with this definition to be clear of, are we really including everybody? That might be okay, actually, because then the stigma might change. But then the second related question to that is, to follow up on what you shared, the first question of just, does this weaken or at all suggest that somehow the current treaties do not apply to migrants, all the human rights treaties? They're all humans. So, you know, I guess this is this, you know, a struggle. And what if we looked at instead active discrimination on the enforcement of freedom of movement, for instance? So that some migrants or some people are denied freedom of movement, but other migrants, other people who move, are welcomed. Do you see that? I'm trying to get at a different way that we might strengthen existing frameworks of human rights tools like the Convention on Racial Discrimination, as opposed to this. I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate since I'm a church kind of guy, so. But help me out on those things of this. You know, seeing whether we could use the discrimination approach as opposed to this new soft law approach. I really like the ideas, but I'm just curious. Thank you.
Sure. So first, to your initial question, at this point, the bill does, in fact, include anyone who crosses a border. Now, with the understanding that there are a number of people who are going to be covered by different bodies of law that are potentially more protective, for example, diplomats, who are covered by a very protective body of law. And so at this point, for many of those reasons that you identify, and also because part of what we are interested in doing is shifting the discourse on migration to focus on migration as those people in movement rather than vulnerable individuals subject to exploitation, which of course are you know, a somewhat sizable percentage of international migrants, but the population is really quite large when envisioned in that way. And then on to the question of weakening treaties. I mean, I recall, or what comes to mind immediately is the guiding principles on internal displacement, where the challenge was really to articulate a principle of international humanitarian law and then apply it to the context of internal displacement. And I think we see our challenge with regard to human rights law as reacting to a move by states to many of which have already done what you're raising a concern that our instrument might do, which is to say, oh, human rights law, that applies to our obligations to our citizens, but not to those non-citizens who are present. And so we think articulating, and in many cases, as we envision our next step of revision, will very clearly use the language, we do in many cases, but we don't completely, use the language of human rights law and just substitute the word migrant for human as a way to rearticulate and emphasize the way in which those obligations already cover migrants. I think your suggestion is very interesting and bears out further thought. I don't have any immediate reaction to the idea of it enforcing non-discrimination. However, I will say that the non-discrimination principle within the Migrants' Bill of Rights was, from a legal perspective, one of the more challenging to work with. But I also think really one of the core normative inclusions of the bill and one of the biggest challenges. And I agree with you that in many cases, if only the norm against discrimination was enforced adequately, many of the other rights violations that we see to migrants would melt away.
If I could just say on that front, in the U.S., it's a group of migrant workers, self-hating migrant workers in Washington, D.C., that are imposing the most stringent anti-immigrant laws. The only one that isn't a migrant can't vote. That's a representative from D.C.
Hello, my name is Dalit Kaplan. I'm an Australian attorney, currently migrant in New York City. In Australia and also in most other destination countries, you see a lot of discourse around deterrence and governments wanting to ensure that any responses to immigration issues incorporates a deterrent strategy as well. And you also see that in much of the more conservative academic discussion. I just completed a master's in the law school at University of Chicago and studied refugee law there, and that was a strong argument in a lot of the academia there. I'm wondering if your work has engaged with that conversation and that discourse, if you think that it's a useful discourse to engage with respect to getting governments on board, because that's clearly an interest for them, or if you feel that it's too much at odds with the rights discourse that's been the focus and the emphasis of your work. Can it be useful at all, or do you think it completely undermines the project? Thank you.
Well, I should say that I agree that it's an advocacy challenge that we'll continue to have to face as we go forward, particularly as we deal with governments. It's something that we've looked at a bit in our seminars, but not something that we've really made a part of our advocacy plan at this point. Trying to figure out whether to leverage that argument or mollify it is not something that we see as an advocacy priority, in part because I think it's so contentious. But it's something that, you know, we'll continue to keep in mind.
I was going to say that there is nothing in the Bill of Rights which seeks to undermine the national government's sovereign right and responsibility to make determinations as to who will enter and who will be able to remain within the territory of a country. That's sort of a starting point. And what it does say is that for those who do enter your territory, these are rights that those individuals hold. And in reference, actually, to the last set of questions, I think I see as being, you know, the broad categories of people who might come under the Bill of Rights is less of an issue for me as much as the time frame and whether there are rights that you get as a result of building equities. And that particularly comes up in the social and economic rights as compared to the due process rights, which I think one can make an argument from day one that you know the due process rights should be there. But I think you could make a strong argument that you have to earn social and economic rights. You know, so the tourist doesn't have access to things that the longer-term resident does. So I think that's something that definitely has to be grappled with. And though, you know, there are very legitimate areas of national sovereignty where governments not only have the right but the responsibility to their own citizens to make sure that migration is well managed and that it follows certain rules. But that isn't a license to deny the rights of the migrants. And that's the balance and tension that I think is really, you know, fundamental to this whole discourse. How do you do both?
And is something that is already built very much into the bill through the equal protection provision that we provide.
Okay. And I think this is going to be the last question, so go ahead.
It's my pleasure and privilege. It's great to see you all here today and see the work that you all have been doing move forward. I'm Eleanor Acer from Human Rights First, and I have two questions that weren't already taken by other participants here today. One is, I know there was some discussion a little while back about whether or not a Bill of Rights versus guiding principles, for example, would be a better approach in this area. So I'd be curious to hear a little bit of your thinking and assessment and, you know, what I'm guessing you decided Bill of Rights made more sense. I'd like to hear some of the thinking on that. And then secondly, I know most of your planning is you know, for the next two-year cycle and leading up to 2013. I'd be curious to hear a little bit about your longer-term thinking. I know it's not going to be as, you know, precise at this point, but how you see the IMBR as being an opportunity or not as the global migration discussions move forward to maybe focus greater attention on migrants' rights and compliance with existing treaties and whether or not you see that as an opportunity or not. So thank you.
Take the first one. The first an excellent question, and I think we've kind of not answered it in choosing the way that we approach it, and that is to say that we've chosen wording that is very much a legally operative wording, a wording that is a document that looks like a Bill of Rights, feels like a Bill of Rights, and at the same time, given its soft law nature, we see it as functioning in many ways as a set of guiding principles, with of course the strong caveat that I mentioned at the beginning, that we see it as something that can enhance and reaffirm existing hard law norms. And so I think that I'm certainly not as familiar as in the long-term debates on this issue, but in terms of our drafting strategy, we felt that articulating the bills of rights, the Bill of Rights, each right as a real right as opposed to a principle directed at states was one that was better for advocacy, better for migrants and for advocates claiming those rights, and also could in the long term continue to promote the development of strong and kind of hard law norms in the long term.
I'll take the second question. Yes, I think we see the guiding principles really as a model. And so, yes, there's a short-term kind of goal for the 2013 high-level dialogue, but more long-term, we really hope that as more people use it and become aware that, A, it strengthens other human rights instruments, ones that are referenced in the commentary, that it is used and that it creates more awareness and dialogue of migrants' rights. And eventually, the guiding principles have now been referenced in Supreme Court decisions in Latin America and are part of national legislation. So seeing that kind of a very long-term goal, we know that's not going to happen in 2 years, but that the norms really take root at international, regional, national, local levels.
Could I also add that I don't see these as two different processes, that you have either a Bill of Migrant Bill of Rights or a set of guiding principles. What the guiding principles on internal displacement did was set out not only the rights of those who were internally displaced, but also the responsibilities of governments towards them and the response and the means by which the international community could make some decisions about whether or not to offer its assistance and wait, almost demanded if it went to the Security Council. I think this is the starting point on that, the first part of that, but we still need principles that really set out what are the responsibilities of governments towards migrants in different circumstances stemming from different contexts. But to do it, that's that balance I was talking about before, that we need to rethink state sovereignty as well as rethinking migrant rights. But I'd like to see the rethinking of the state sovereignty side of it in the context of a better understanding of what are the priority or core fundamental rights of the migrants so that it builds on that aspect. So I don't see it as either or. I think a necessary next step actually is to do a full set of guiding principles that address state role and the international role. And when does the international community have a responsibility to evacuate migrant workers? I don't know. I don't think we've ever really talked about that. Certainly as the UNHCR and IOM have gone through the fundraising to try to get money to help out in that process, you know, that it's been a very ad hoc process and they have not gotten the resources that they need. But we don't have a statement, you know, with a consensus about is this something that the state does or is there a role for the international community? And that's the guiding principles part of this.
Thank you very much to our three speakers, to Ian Cassell, to Bianca Santos, and to Susan Martin. And then one final comment, and that is I started by saying that in recent times, the initiative and impetus for various advances in rights has emerged from civil society. What I didn't say is that I'm not aware of any instance in which the initiative and impetus emanated from universities and especially not from students at universities. So this is novel in that respect. I think you've launched a wonderful trend, and I congratulate all involved. Thank you very much.